Hi, I'm Len Epp from LeanPub, and in this episode of the LeanPub podcast, I'll be interviewing Danielle Boyce. Based in upstate New York, Danielle is Principal Investigator Real World Evidence at the ALS Therapy Development Institute. She's an experienced data engineer and analyst with graduate degrees in public health and public administration. She also serves as a faculty member at Johns Hopkins, a biomedical informatics and data science section, and holds affiliations with the University of Calgary and Emory University. And in addition, she is a technical consultant for data for the common good at the University of Chicago. You can follow her on LinkedIn, very easy to find, at data-danielle, and check out the website at, I'll put a link in the show notes, but it's alstdi.github.io/als-rwe. Danielle is the author of the book, 10 Habits of Great Data Analysts, Practical Tips from My Three Decades in the Field. Here's the book description is, after more than 30 years working with researchers, clinicians, students, and patient advocacy organizations, Dr. Boyce has seen the same challenges appear again and again. Talented analysts who were never taught how to work in real research environments, research teams struggling to collaborate effectively with analysts, organizations collectively collecting valuable data but unsure how to turn those data into meaningful insights, and people who believe they are not a data person, which is something we can talk about pretty soon. So in this interview, we're going to talk about Danielle's background and career and professional interests and this really great book. And at the end, we'll talk a little bit about her experience writing. So thank you very much, Danielle, for being on a LeanPub podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's really a pleasure.
I always like to start these interviews by asking people for their origin story. You talk about yours a little bit at the beginning of the book. So I was wondering if you could talk about, you know, where you grew up and how you found yourself on your path into the career that you've built.
Sure. Yeah. So I took an unusual path to data analytics and science in general. I grew up in a very rural community, northern New York, called Croghan, New York, with more cows than people. It used to be home of the Lumberjack Festival, if that gives you an idea, and the International Maple Syrup Museum. And so, as you can imagine, you know, I didn't really have a lot of role models there who were doing science. I had a lot of smart role models and a lot of brilliant people, but there just weren't jobs like that. There wasn't a university nearby outside of the community college. And so I never saw anyone who worked who was not a teacher or a nurse, for example. And so it was not on my radar, let's put it that way. And on top of that, you know, years ago, I'm in my 50s now, and years ago, I think there was a conscious or unconscious bias against women in science in general and math. But very fortunately, I had very encouraging, intelligent parents who told me I could be anything I wanted, but this just never came up. And so I went to Binghamton University, a state university in New York, and I decided I wanted to do political science. And because I, you know, had a lot of causes that I was interested in, I probably would have done arts. Actually, I love textile design and arts and crafts, but I just, somebody from my background, I just didn't have any mentoring. There was no real internet access back then. And so there was no way for me to really figure out how to go about that. And so political science was a close one because I saw the injustice of all of that. Why can't I go to art school? Because I'm from a rural community. So I knew a lot about that. I knew a lot of people who were on public assistance. I knew a lot of people who were on Medicaid. I knew a lot about that part of government and public administration. And so I thought I would leverage that into a career. I knew I was good at school, but I was very intimidated by math and science. That is until I started working as a teaching assistant and a research assistant in the political science department. And I worked with people who were doing like dissertation research, survey research, and things like that using statistical software. That is how I got my initial exposure to SPSS, which is at the time, there were other programs, but that was kind of the most commonly used software, I think, in social sciences at the time. And so I realized, wow, I'm actually pretty good at programming, and I like this. I like doing this work. And initially, I didn't do a ton of programming. I was intimidated by that. It was more like through the user interface. But I picked it up, and then suddenly I realized, you know, this could support me, this kind of work. So I made myself like it. You know, initially I didn't love it, but I thought this could be a way to work with really smart people on causes that I care about, I could be very valuable in the workforce. I could support myself. And, you know, of course, when you're, you come from a background like mine, that is definitely in the back of your mind. Like, you don't have a huge safety net. So you have to kind of think of something that's going to be versatile. So I graduated with a BA in political science, and I found my way to Washington, D.C. And I worked right around the time, I remember I moved there the weekend of the Lewinsky scandal broke. Oh. So that tells you that period of time where I was living. So, but D.C. was a really vibrant time. It was right around the dot-com boom.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worked on a number of government projects for Beltway consulting firms. And it bothered me. I didn't have my master's yet because I couldn't get promoted. I wanted to be as a research assistant, and I wanted to be a research associate. And I couldn't be a research associate because I didn't have my master's. So I thought, okay, now I'm gonna pick something that will get me that research associate job. So I picked the most complicated thing I could think of that would be the most versatile, and that was epidemiology. So I did my master's in public health epidemiology. I started out at George Washington. And then moved back to New York when my father was ill. He's fine now, but I moved back to New York to finish at SUNY Albany, and was very fortunate at that time to be associated with the public health department, the state New York State Health Department in Albany, which is where I learned SAS and really got into coding and programming. And, you know, the statistics came. You want something bad enough, it's funny, you believe in yourself, you pick it up. And so pretty soon I was actually not just good at coding, but also good at statistics and epi. And I had to work really hard at it. It did not come naturally to me, but now obviously it does, just from practice. And so long and windy, twisty road, but I wound up back in DC, and then I was recruited to Johns Hopkins working in the pulmonary division as a research assistant on a pulmonary hypertension project. Did I know anything about pulmonary hypertension? No. Did I sound enthusiastic in the interview? Yes, because I really wanted to work at Johns Hopkins, and mm-hmm. I would have just done it. I would have learned anything, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I just want to work here and I'll figure mm-hmm. it out later. And mm-hmm. so that's what I did, and kind of became known as someone who could just come in, pick things up, go get her. And it led to one door opening and another door opening. And then I had my son, Charlie, my second child. And Charlie had a really catastrophic form of epilepsy called infantile spasms. He's now 16 and he's kind of like an infant. We have to care for him, like all of his needs. And that really changed the way I look at everything. You know, I thought all the problems were there to be solved. I just didn't know about it. Yeah, I didn't know the solution. And I realized most people don't know a lot about some of these rare diseases. And it kind of made me think about real world evidence, like electronic health records and patient registries. It really changed my perspective, my sense of urgency. Just changed a lot of things and my interest in how to get drugs approved. And so I went back to school for my doctorate in public administration.
Mm-hmm.
I did that really because I wanted to get a PhD in bureaucracy. You know, like if you have a kid like mine, you need to be able to navigate, never thinking the doors would open. I never thinking really how much it would tie to the data work that I do and how valuable that would make me having those things combined. I was interested in it. So I did that at night. And then that opened faculty position at Hopkins. I fell in love with ALS community and the motor neuron disease. It seemed like something that was close to as bad as what my son had. You know, that's how it felt to me. Like, that really scratches that itch. It feels meaningful and worth my time. And so here I am. And that's what I do. And the book, why I was interested in, you know, in the back of my mind, I've been thinking I've been wanting to write a book because I've noticed just kind of the way that things are moving in AI, you know, in analytics, you know, through my students at Hopkins, these really brilliant young people who don't really know how to navigate a data analytics project in the real world. And so what I would hear is, oh, I wish we could clone you, Danielle, right? And And it's like, you know, I'm not that great of a programmer. Like, I'm not like I didn't get a great SAT. Like, I'm really, it's not really my skill set that you're attracted to. It's all these other things that I do. And so I want to, especially as AI becomes so quick and easy, like, we really need to remember these basic fundamentals so that we, you know, we really understand the science and ethics and all of that. And so that's kind of something that I just haven't seen a book about. So that's what inspired me to write it.
Well, thanks very much for sharing that really great story and the path all the way down to the book that we're talking about. That was very, very, very well done, podcast guest.
Thank you
very much for that.
I listen to a lot of podcasts.
Yeah, that was excellent. Thank you. One thing I really liked about the story you just told and that you talk about at the beginning of your book. You know, I'm from a kind of rural place. I'm from the province of Saskatchewan in Canada, and we're more or less the same kind of vintage. And so one thing that I think is often kind of lost, I think, in trying to communicate. I mean, there's still people who are from, you know, kind of places where you don't know a lot about the world and you don't have a lot of exposure. But pre-internet, you know, that kind of isolation, or if you're living in a place in the world now without internet and stuff like that, or computers and availability, like, you really didn't know much about the world unless you really did put your effort into it. And so I grew up in the kind of cities in Saskatchewan, which had like 150,000 people in them. But, you know, my parents grew up on farms, and, like, you know, where I grew up, it was pretentious to go to the Irish bar because that was ethnic.
Right.
You know,
that's right.
I love to tell that
fancy,
joke, but it's true.
Yeah. Drinking wine out of a box is, you know, like, right. Like, it's, yes. And it's so it's very hard to explain that, you know, how bold I had.
Yes.
I think about that. How bold was I? And not only that, but I graduated from high school in 3 years. All of my friends were having babies in high school. We had a very high teen pregnancy rate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because in many ways, well, what do we have to look forward to? You know, might as well start my life now. This is what, in fact, I had a person in the school system tell me, what are you doing? Because you're just going to get married and come back here. Why are you? Because I want to do something with my life. I don't know what. I maybe want to go to art school. And I was so discouraged from that. And so I think back, like, what was I made of? Like, I have a 17-year-old daughter now, you know, and I think, gosh, that was, I must have known there was something bigger for me. And I definitely was driven by service. And that is something that you do get a lot in these rural communities, is this sense of caring for one another and service. And so I do think that, I mean, everything great that I am is really because of that background. However, to your point, there were a lot of naysayers. I was quite bullied. We call it bullying now. I mean, I dealt with that quite a bit. I was different. It wasn't cool to be smart and in some certain many circles. It was intimidating. I can say that that has all healed now. But it wasn't that way back then.
Yeah, it's you're sort of setting off sort of memories of mine as well about the kind of, like, you know, first of all, some people just have it in them, right? So, like, my big move was from Saskatoon to London in 1999.
Wow.
And I remember people asking me, like, oh, don't you feel like out of you know, sorts in the big city? And I was like, what I felt like was a whale that had been raised in an aquarium and was now in the ocean. And I'm like, oh, this is how it's supposed to be. You know,
yes.
That was just like that. It's like, oh, right. So, like, you know, not to disparage or denigrate anything, except for what we now call bullying or what have you. But
yeah,
like,
my brother's always lived here, you know, he's very bright and, you know, extremely intelligent and has lived a very rich life. He's an artist. He plays music. And, you know, so but for those of us with desires that cannot be fulfilled, you know, if you're not a teacher, nurse or healthcare, or if it isn't for you, I mean, now I have four kids, so now I have, you know, all of it. But but if it's not for you, it's very hard to describe that. And I remember, but, you know, it's funny because my mother didn't go to college. My dad went to college on the GI Bill after Vietnam era service. And so these were people who did not themselves fulfill, you know, what maybe they will not even not fulfill their dream. I don't even know if they even had that image of themselves. It was like, I'm going to serve my family. I'm going to serve my kids. Like, I don't even think, you don't even know how to dream a dream. You don't learn how to mm-hmm. do that in some places. And I say we are privileged. I mean, we were not, I was not poor. My dad was a teacher. He worked two jobs for 30 years. And he was a teacher at the local high school, and then he worked as an immigration officer at the Canadian border, and he did that for almost 30 years so we could, you know, go to school. But what was funny was, though, it's not just me, it was my family. Like, whatever would possess my mother, you know, first house was a trailer, you know, like whatever possessed her to say, listen, when you go to college, you're going to be invited to a dance and I will buy you the nicest dress. Because she knew this was a painful time, you know, painful mm-hmm. for me. And mm-hmm. she said, I'm gonna spend all my money when you're in college and you'll be invited to it. And that's exactly what she said. It's not like this forever. You know, it won't right. be like this. You're gonna be something, you know. So it wasn't like an escape from my family, which is why I love living here now. Mm-hmm. And I found such a rich community of people who maybe had similar experiences and now are back for various reasons. It's been a very healing experience, but yes, that's a great way to put it, like a whale. Like, no, it was just give it all to me. Every museum and mm-hmm. the library, like I could, it just, everything was just so incredible for me. And I think that's why we need, I mean, tying it back to the data science in the book, like right. that is why diversity, that is why I want to encourage people to think again if they think they're not a data person. Just give it a shot. And that's also why I wanted to put my picture on the book, not because I'm, you know, Heidi Klum, but because I wanted people to see themselves, maybe, or someone who looks like someone who might like them and accept them. That's what I wanted from that.
Yeah, that's a very thoughtful cover. And it does do that. It's very, I was sort of wondering about that. And so just before we go on to talk about the book, in detail, I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about your day job. You mentioned that, you know, a lot of like the diseases, like the one your son has, but also ALS, you know, people will have heard of ALS more, but, you know, might not know what it is. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what ALS is and the kind of work that you and your, sure. your organization do.
Yeah, absolutely. So ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or some people around the world, is generally called a motor neuron disease, you know, and that's kind of a umbrella term. It's a condition where your motor neurons die, and it can lead to paralyzation. You can lose your ability to speak. You can lose your ability to breathe, and it kills most people who have it within the first 5 years after diagnosis. Lou Gehrig's disease, you might know it as Lou Gehrig's disease, and Eric Dane, sadly, is a recent celebrity who passed away from ALS. And it's actually not quite as rare as people might think. It's because people die so quickly that it's not, you don't have the prevalence, you know, that you might for another disease where you live a long time. So there's lots of people around you that have it. ALS Therapy Development Institute is a nonprofit biotech devoted specifically to finding cures and treatments for and ending ALS. And so I have been working in ALS for several years before I came over to ALS TDI. I used to be the executive director of the Packard Center for ALS Research at Johns Hopkins. And around that time, I met Fernando Vieira, who is our CEO, CSO. He's a physician by training. I met him back then, and we knew immediately that we needed to collaborate because he is a kindred spirit. And after working in academia for so long, as much as I love it, there's also something really refreshing about a biotech. Because there's so much freedom, you know, that in the no bureaucracy, and it's so small, and that's exciting. And we have a big lab, so we have cell biology, we have animals, we have the whole thing, all the drug development, anything you would need. And so my job at ALS TDI is I am really a servant. I am in service to that work in the lab. I run the real world evidence, and I run that little piece of it, but we have a big team that, you know, we all work together But we have a long-running natural history study called the ARC, ALS Research Collaborative, and where we will send someone to your home if you have ALS for a blood draw. So we have biological samples, which are essential in understanding the subtypes and the causes of ALS. 90% or more of people with ALS, we do not know if they have a genetic mutation or what happened, which makes it very difficult to do clinical trials and understand which drug is going to work with which person. So you might enroll people who the drug would never work for, but you don't know that because you don't understand the subtypes. So what I do is take the data from the surveys. So with the people who participate in our study are so generous with their time and their data. They give us survey information about their risk factor history, their medical history, and their experience with ALS. They, on a monthly basis, submit what's called the ALS Functional Rating Scale, which tells us where their progression is over time. We have digital data that we collect, voice data, accelerometer data, so we can measure the decline that way, or if they're staying steady, that too. And we also have an innovative way of receiving their electronic health records directly from them. And we pull those in through FHIR or CCDA, so standard EHR approaches. And so my job is to put all of that together or lead the team that puts all of that together and try to tell those stories. And so we give that information to the people doing the omics, the proteomics, and the genomics research. And we try to use the information that they share to understand progression patterns, see if we can find different categories of ALS, let's say, or different types of ALS, which would help us to better understand the disease and maybe develop unique treatments for these different groups. And I'm very inspired by my work in epilepsy, my son, because what I've seen, you know, when Charlie was born, they would test you for just a few genes. And that's it. And then if you weren't one of those genes, then they don't know what happened. And it was very much like ALS. But I think because it's parents, you know, moms and dads, you know, what won't you do for your kid? And what won't you learn? And what won't you push for? So we pushed for all the kids to get genetic testing, no matter how expensive it was. U.S. insurance is really a disaster when it comes to that stuff. But we pushed for it. And we had great partnership with industry. So all of a sudden, these kids were, this was happening, what I want to do with ALS was happening in epilepsy, where kids were they were discovering the genes because you had enough of the clinical phenotyping data, the presentations in these natural history studies, that you could figure out which of these genes really did seem to be pathogenic in these cases and which were just unknown significance or benign. And so suddenly, there's 100 groups in rare epilepsy representing unique genes, which is what we're doing in ALS. Like, we're trying to do that in ALS if possible, if it is represented by genes, we don't know. And then there's also this environmental component, because military, people in the military are much more likely to get ALS than not. Why? Well, is there an environmental thing that, you know, exposure? Probably, right? But like what? So my job is to solve that mystery. That's what we're doing. And so taking all the data from all of these sources, putting it all together and working with the real brilliant folks on our team, how do you want the data? What can I do to make the data so that we can make those discoveries? And so that's what we do at ALS TDI. I love it. I just love working there.
It sounds incredible. And it's just sort of like working at sort of all kinds of different levels, like with the people who, and the families who themselves are sort of, yes, you know, have ALS, and then all the way through you to the people who are doing the high level research. Just one question I have about that before we, since I've got you here, so I'm selfishly going to ask, is this kind of research typically national? Like, is it done, would you be sharing your information with, like, say, like finding out, does the UK military also, with UK militaries, like, yes, is that information shared internet? I mean, it makes sense that it would happen kind of data gathering would happen, yes, kind of locally to some extent. And then since it's research, there might be national programs and stuff, but is there, yes, international cooperation basically is my
question. Absolutely. So we have, is one of the great things about ALS TDI. So we're an open science shop. We just want to get to the bottom of this. We don't we don't care who figures it out with our data. Like, right. Okay. Please take our data and solve this, because mm-hmm. we hate ALS, and just put us out of business. You know, that's mm-hmm. kind of the way we look at it. So we share our data openly. So we have the ARC Data Commons, and you can, as a researcher, you can sign up for the ARC Data Commons, and with a data use agreement, you know, you have to obviously with our institutional review board, make sure, you know, you're who you say you are, but then we will give you access. We have a Looker, you know, Google Looker, platform, and you can come in and get all of our results. And in fact, we had a meeting today about how I can push more of the EHR data out into that platform as well. And so we also work with the CDC ALS registry. So CDC has a registry, a little different in what they can do than what we can do, but there's also ways of joining up our participants with theirs through global unique identifiers, so we can figure out who's who. And that's in the works. And so we also work internationally. There's some brilliant researchers all around the world. Can't name them all. And I've worked with them. I have a paper with someone from the Netherlands, someone from the UK, like, and they have the UK Biobank. And so, in fact, I was just talking to someone the other day, they ran something in the UK Biobank data, and they wondered if we could run it in our samples. Mm. So it is a wonderful international community. And I realize that you would never get into this. This is a difficult, sad, not a lot of quick wins, you know, in this one, you know, and it really is reflected in the people who want to do it. You know, it's really people who will do anything, and they're not selfish, you know, by and large. And that to me was another big selling point, because when you have a person in your life with a rare and poorly understood disease, it turns your stomach when people are territorial and,
right,
you know, about money and things. Like, it's just, mm-hmm. ugh, you know, I would never. So yeah, that is a very important point. So I'm glad you asked that.
Thanks very much. And so with that context, now we can move on to the next part of the interview, where we actually start talking about the book, 10 Habits yeah. of Great Data Analysts. And I love the idea that, you know, that you know, having put it in this sort of very serious and, but at the same time, kind of passionate kind of context, because I think a lot of people can, you know, think of, like, they hear data analysis and they think, you know, I mean, this is a dated reference, but like green eye shade, pencil behind the ear, kind of boring yes. thing. But your book is full of terms like explore. And, you know, discover and things like that. And so it really comes across that there's, like, much more than that going on. And so one, I guess the first thing I'd like to ask you is, can you define, like, data analysis or what it means to be a data analyst?
Oh, you know, it's funny because, you know, it used to mean something different, I think. In my career, I've seen it kind of change. And I don't know how I feel about that. You know, it used to be, if you were the data analyst, you were also the IT person and you were the informatician. You know, in my case, if we transferred over to Epic, you know, the big EHR software. And so then you're like the Epic person, and, you know, and in fact, I have a cape that I used to wear when I was working in academia, and it was RFNP, random female non-physician, because I felt like I was just doing whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. To me though, data analytics at its heart is the process of taking raw data and gleaning insight, you know, from it, and whatever that may be, and that could be big data with AI, you know, or it could be, you know, just a survey, you know, you get a Qualtrics survey and analyzing it, and making meaning of it and summarizing it. But really the data analyst job, which I hope gets across in the book, is really project management. Sometimes it's, you know, psychiatrist, you know, sometimes it's, you know, social worker, you know, comforter, you know, bad news giver. Sometimes it's creative, you know, so there's lots of different ways that a data analyst can contribute. In the past, it was really, I've seen it as kind of like a gateway job. You know, oftentimes that's how it's seen. Like, I'm going to take this data analytics job in between my senior year and maybe I'll go to medical school. And that's fine. And that's great. It's great experience. But it is a serious job in and of itself. You can make a career as a data analyst, and you don't have to do anything more than that. You know, you can stay as a data analyst and do plenty, and grow, and just like I did, you know, but it's, you really have to have a certain mindset in order for it to stay the job, you know, stay in the job and be fulfilled and continue getting promotions and making more money too, which is no small part of it too.
And how would you characterize that mindset? I mean, obviously being passionate about what you're doing would be an important part of it, but I imagine stubbornness is probably, you know, just not stopping because you can't, you haven't found an answer yet. You just keep going.
Yes. Being resilient, being persistent, you know, sticking to your guns, I think is really important too. You know, it's hard. You're oftentimes a young person, in an environment, intimidating environment. So you're from right off the turnip truck, like I was, you know, now you're with these people who were not off the turnip truck, you know, so that in and of itself, right? And, and I mean, there aren't that many people, but I hope there will be, but you know, that's some feeling that you have, or even if you just graduated from my program at Hopkins with a master's degree, it's very intimidating. So you come in and you're probably not going to know what they're talking about. They're talking about pulmonary hypertension. I didn't know anything about that, you know, got to learn it really fast, you know? So it's about going into a situation like that and knowing what you know, and knowing who you are, and knowing what you're finding, and sticking to your guns, and finding creative solutions. I give some examples like that in the book, finding creative solutions when things don't work out as planned. Because at the end of the day, this is part of a larger ecosystem. These are people's jobs. These are people's grants. You know, when you're working with a lot of doctors, they often have pressure to publish papers, to get grants with the data that you analyze. You have funders who want results, and you might not necessarily interface with all of those stakeholders, but you'll feel the pressure sometimes to do a good job. And there's also just the resilience that you need when everybody's using Stata. Like at Hopkins, when I came in, I'd never used Stata before, but all of the younger doctors I worked with, they often get an MHS or MPH, and their program, they learn Stata. And I did not know Stata at all. And some people would have said, well, I don't know Stata, so I guess I'll what, like work at the mall? Like that was not an option for me. Hopkins wanted me, and I was going to figure it out. And so I learned Stata, and because the output was in a way that they learned on, you know, they learned how to interpret regression results there. So who am I to tell them now you have to learn something else? So that, you know, and so it's also about being flexible, which is not always a strong suit for people who have been told their whole life that they're really, really smart and great at data analytics. You know, sometimes it's hard to be humbled, you know, and flexible. And it's also about project management too.
You were just reminding me of something there, something you said about, you know, getting grants and the sort of like what's at stake in the gathering and analysis, and but in particular, the presentation of data. And I interviewed an author years ago, also an American author who, I think he was a co-author of a book called Education Data Done Right. And I forget exactly what it was, but he had to do some, he kind of came up with a very effective way of communicating a result from some education data that had an impact, specifically because of the way he presented it to, I think it was either a city council or some kind of state level education funding board or something like that. And I think what he had done is like people had been misled by the way certain kind of education output data had been presented to them. And when I think, for example, it was as simple as comparing his state's outcomes to other states' outcomes, rather than just showing his state's outcomes, that sort of proved, oh, our education policy here and there is actually working. Mm-hmm. And it was so fascinating because, you know, it's kind of like the people think data, they think it's, you know, one immutable thing. But like there's so much more going on when it comes to the world of data, and in particular how people perceive it.
That's right.
What's your approach to, I guess, to that, to like kind of, I mean, if you're preparing something for people who are just going to believe what they see, how do you approach that challenge? Because I mean, like, I just very briefly, like I've spent some time as an investment banker and stuff like that. And one thing I learned was like, when you show people numbers, when you show people a chart, even if it's like a projection based on kind of all kinds of sophisticated, like, potential outcomes, they think what you show them is what's going to happen. It's kind of crazy. Like, you, no matter how much you say this is just a projection based on a 10% likelihood of 100 different things, people just believe what you show them.
That's right. And that's very relevant when you're working in a disease like ALS and you work closely with the community. And it's why it's very unethical to call things breakthrough.
Right.
Right. And oftentimes, you're the one who feels the heat because you didn't have the breakthrough, right? Like, and I deal with that a lot. And that's a me problem. You know, I have to absorb that, you know, disappointment, that, you know, the perception, or if the funder doesn't like the disappointing information, you know, that it's not cured or solved.
Right.
And I think that's science broadly, but I definitely feel that, you know, like, in our data, we might have missing data, you know, for example. And so the sample size is small. And so it's very easy to say we have so many more, you know, such a high proportion of people who reported X comorbidity. And then that you say that. And I've experienced this, it, just like you said, no matter how much you couch it or whatever, if, you know, we were talking about autoimmune disease and, you know, it's a known thing in ALS, it fits in there somewhere, and everybody, that's well known. But if I were to say, you know, I don't know, a certain percentage of people, I don't want to say it on here because people take, but if I were to say like a certain percentage of people in our subset, who, you know, but not controlling for anything, and who knows if they would have already had it anyway, or, you know, who knows how it compares to the rest of the population, you know, it could be just the same. But if I were to say that, they might come home and say, oh, autoimmune disease, I caused it myself, or it's because of this, or, you know, they'll come and tell their child, or, you know, whatever it is. So you have to be responsible with that. But at the same time, it is a business, and there's also stuff that is exciting and you want to communicate because you want other scientists to see it and grab onto it and validate it, you know, and replicate it, you know? So, yeah, I mean, even today I was giving I had a team meeting and I shared my screen, and all I was doing was restructuring data from FIRE to show them what this would look like. And I gave an example of how it would connect to another set of data that we had. So this would be our internal patient ID, and I've linked it to this, but it's just what it would, just look at the structure. Don't look if this is the real person. But of course our instinct was to go, and everybody looked up. Did that person really enroll in this date? And I'm like, you know, that's not what I'm not. So you can, and that's internal team. So it is, and it's also a challenge to communicate correlation and causation, you know, so things like that. Like, you know, this isn't controlling for anything. This isn't controlling for what genetic mutation they have. It's not controlling for that. So it's just descriptive. You have to remember that you're the only one in this room that went to school for this. You know, and so my general approach is to speak in more general terms, unless I'm ready for somebody to latch on to that number. Because like you said, once it's there, you can't take it back. And it's also true about publications. When, you know, in my early days at Hopkins, I would be so nervous, even if I knew I was right. Because when they publish stuff, people latch on to that number and use it. Like, it can influence clinical practice. And there was one biomarker that, I mean, thank God I was too naive to even really understand the significant. I didn't even know how big time, you know, these people I was working with were. And I calculated this thing, and thank God I didn't really understand like what would happen. And then it became a thing. And people use that number that I calculated to help determine, you know, if their patient had, you know, a disease or not, you know, a non-invasive way of doing this. And so, yeah, it's a solemn responsibility, and it's, it, and I wish everybody thought that way, and not everybody does. And people can be very careless and hurtful with numbers and the way they use it to weaponize against people and like in social causes as well, you know? So, that's a very important point.
Yeah. And it's the frustration of when you've been behind the kind of production of data like that, whether it's in, you know, science or finance or something like that, you really do. Like, I guess what I was expressing was something you got to, like, you would address at the end there, was that these things can be used maliciously by people who just, like, we don't normally like to think this way, but like a lot of people are vulnerable to manipulation. And it's as straightforward as just believing what they see and believing what they read and they're told without, and you know, we all have aspects of our lives, I'm sure, the dimensions of our engagement with the world where we're naive about that with some things, but like people really are vulnerable to intentional or unintentional, you know, manipulation, because they really do just kind of believe what they see. And it's one of the huge challenges. One thing that your book led me to think about was, how human, you know, you reminded me that how human the cover is, but how human the kind of, you know, the sort of 10 points that you're making are about, like, you know, the first one is understand the science and the people, you know, that kind of thing. Documentation, for example, is one of the points. Like, that's what documentation is. I mean, it's about other people, including future you, who is kind of another person. We've all had that experience where you're like, kind of like, I'm very glad that past me wrote that down.
Yeah, exactly.
Present me would not have been able to reconstruct that in my head. But there's one thing I remember I used to study. This might sound funny, like a funny segue, but like I used to study Chinese martial arts. And it was a very specific style called flying crane. And this was with a really great teacher in Montreal. And his sort of sifu had been from Malaysia. And it was this one family. And the thing about when you do something like, I'm sure ballet is like this as well, you realize a lot of it can't be, a lot of the practices, a lot of what you're actually up to can be lost.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of like, you know, with my sifu, like if your hand was not quite right, he'd move it. He'd touch you and move your hand the right way. Or when you're doing like kind of joint lock kind of stuff, like chin na, it's called, you know, you really can't figure it out until someone does it to you. And then you have to try it a lot of times yourself. And it's like, if my teacher just stopped teaching and everybody kind of, all the students kind of went away along with the rest of their lives, like, you know, like I did eventually, there's no way that, like, he's written books and stuff like that, but there's no way you can reconstruct that. And similarly, I think, you know, if all ballet stopped in the world 100 years, you'd basically have to reinvent it. And that would take a long time. So I'm asking that in the context of, like, when it comes to scientific research and funding for scientists and graduate students and PhDs and stuff like that. I think a lot of us think, oh, it's kind of like we can just kind of pull it off the shelf again later if we need to, that science progresses and there's a kind of, it can't fall back. But if reading, you know, books like yours makes it quite clear that that is not the case, that there's a lot of lived practice that yes, science is. It's not just the paper's been published, so now the science is done forever and can be, you know, reclaimed later if we need to.
Yeah, there's so much mentoring and chain of mentoring, you know, that you've worked in someone's lab over years. And so you've learned from not only that first person who runs the lab, but then all of the generations of people, the culture, the mindset. I mean, and like you said, I can't imagine if we just turned it off, you know, that I can't tell you how fortunate I feel right now that I made the decision to do full time at a nonprofit biotech that wasn't fully dependent on federal funds. Let's just put it that way. Mm-hmm. Very, very fortunate right now, because so many people in academia are really struggling, much more than any of the circles in academia I travel in, which are fortunately some of the more funded, you know, kind of groups. But everyone is dealing with that right now. Yeah, and it's also the person, you know, if you take the person out of doing, like to your point, to take the person out of it, you lose stuff, you know, you lose the mojo, which is why I always have a million things going on at once and why I love my job. Because while I lead things and do talks and write papers and all that stuff, I get to do the data stuff still. And I still, like, we're small and scrappy, but every day I can go in and tinker. And even if it's just setting something up for someone on my team to take over. So I'm worried about science right now. Not worried about my organization. And that is such a gift. And I know I'm so grateful, and I know how fortunate I am. But I'm worried. I'm also worried about the lack of diversity in science right now, and what all of these cuts to diversity. I'm worried about how is that going to affect us down the road? Because I'm very good at some things because I come from a rural community. I'm very good at, I get things. I'm good at talking to people from different backgrounds, which makes me good at, like, qualitative research and recruiting and science communication. And likewise, if you're from a community that doesn't have a good built environment, sidewalks and things and lots, and you have a lot of violence, then you are going to bring a certain perspective to data science that I couldn't, because I didn't grow up like that. And it's just a fact. And so I worry that we're cutting our funding, and we're intentionally not recruiting people from diverse backgrounds. And I worry that, like, 5 years, if this gets turned on again, where are we going to be? I worry about the choices that we need to make sometimes because of the, you know, nature of whatever funds are available, you know, and I review grants for different agencies, and the number of applications is very high. I heard today that there was just so many applications for this one thing that I'm reviewing, because just there's so much competition now for the few resources there are. So yeah, I am concerned, but I do also know that there is a really rich open science volunteer community, and we're keeping it going. Like, we're doing it, we're keeping it going. And on the other hand, it's also a great opportunity for scrappy people like me who did a lot of volunteering. You know, I didn't get paid for a lot of the things I did. I would call up a doctor I met and say, hey, do you need a helper? I'll do it for free because I want to learn this. So there's a lot of opportunities like that. A lot of people want to put it back together.
Well, thank you for that very, very good and moving answer. I really appreciate you talking about that. And in particular, I mean, you know, having been in a way a kind of, you know, outsider myself in various points in my life, you know, I ended up at a sort of big name university for my doctorate, and, like, you know, at the kind of, like, banquet for matriculation, you know, I was between two 18-year-olds who were, you know, I was 25, who were, like, more polished and sophisticated than I was ever going to be in my life. You know, knowing that, like, there's, when we're talking about kind of different points of view and perspectives and stuff like that, you know, there's a lot of selecting that goes on that is, in fact, for someone's, the way they were raised, basically, or the way they grew up, rather than for talent or hard work or potential. Right. And
there's
stuff
a
like
lot
that.
Of that. And yeah. I got lucky because the world is still not kind, you know, it just isn't. Mm-hmm. And that's a fact. And that doesn't take away from the wonderful qualified people who did not have the kind of situation that, you know, where I'm coming from. Mm-hmm. But even just the fact that I went to a state college, I mean, I'll call that out. People look at that, maybe, you know, like, they meet me, they think I'm brilliant. And then they say, oh, where'd you go? You know, I see the face. Like, yeah. I know I'm not like, I listen, it's in, and I'm just stating a fact that is the way that it is. But also just think about it. Like, I've had 4 kids. So who's going to be better at scanning a database of maternal and child health outcomes? Me or some, I mean, probably me, you know, it's just a fact, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, so that's diversity, man. Like, here's for it, you know, and we can't afford to be picky. We have lots of urgent things happening, and ALS is one of them. And so we really can't afford to exclude anyone. Anyone who wants to join this needs to, and we need to roll out the red carpet for anyone who's interested in working in science. We need to make a concerted effort. This is not about gatekeeping. I live with a 16-year-old who wears diapers and needs 24-hour care. It's disgusting that we would do anything to exclude or to limit anyone's opportunity to work in this field. We really need to get all hands on deck. And so that's what's most concerning to me, that we would do anything to discourage anyone from going into science.
Just moving on to the last part of the interview, in the interest of time, I know we could talk about this a lot longer, to talk about the writing of your book. And I was just curious of what your approach is. I've talked to lots of different people. You know, there's kind of, I tell my family Saturday afternoons, I'm going to be in that room. Don't come in. There's other people who are like cafes only. You know, there are people who only write on airplanes. Do you have an approach?
Oh, so I've been noodling on this book and some other things I'm working. I always have a lot of little things cooking. And for years, I've been thinking about this. So I dictate a lot into my phone. I do, because I usually am holding the baby, or, you know, like that's how I did my dissertation. I had tons of kids. I had little ones at the time. So I would be like holding the baby, washing dishes, dictating into my phone. And then I would, that was a pretty good process. And it would be like in my Gmail draft. And then I would get back when I get up every day at 4 a.m. And I say I'm planning my empire. That's what I tell the kid, because nobody's up at that time. Or maybe sometimes Charlie is. And so then I transfer it into a document and clean it up and edit it. And it's often really messy. And I tell myself it's going to be terrible. So like I don't expect perfection, because that's another thing people think it has to be perfect. I'm not the best writer. I'm a very good data analyst. I have the spirit and the heart, but in terms of the technical pieces, I'm not a great writer. I love to use like AI tools that help me to clean up my grammar and things. The Word, you know, Microsoft Word has those tools. Google Docs have those tools. I don't like AI because it'll change things that, so that's a little, you know, it'll say like data is instead of data are, which I'm a data are kind of gal. It'll change your voice. And so I don't encourage you to use AI for things like that, you know, for like really giving your voice. But I do like it for helping with like sentence structure and things like that. But yeah, I just dictate into my phone, clean it up. Sometimes I use it as is, and then I just sit and I just let it rest. And then I work on something else. So I knit and crochet, and I'll have like four or five works in progress, because different days, my heart is feeling something different. And so I need something different from the work. And then finally I'll know it's done. But even when I was uploading it to LeanPub, I think I changed it like 20 times, which I loved about LeanPub. Like I love that I could change it. I goofed up. Oh, I didn't like how I said that. Let me change that real quick. And then I really felt solid, and then it was ready to go.
Yeah, thanks very much for sharing that. I love the idea of the image of you know, having holding a baby and, you know, doing dishes or some other task, and then dictating at the same time. Yeah. I had two friends who were doing PhDs when they had their first or was it their second child? And yeah, one of them was the 4 a.m. in the shed out back working on his doctorate, and the other one was, you know, sleeping.
Listen, I could be farming, you know, like I have friends who, you know, first of all, don't get to choose the life that they want. I have plenty of friends that didn't get to wake up at 4 a.m. to write a nice book, mm-hmm. you know, so it you know, it seems really hard for those of us who live in like very luxurious lives now, but mm-hmm. like there's plenty of people who are working at Taco Bell. Mm-hmm. And they have to get up at 4 a.m., you know, mm-hmm. so this is a pleasure. And if you want something, you can, you just make time, you do it. People say all the time, you have four kids, how do you do everything? If you want something, you will do it. You will do it. Now, my nails are never done. I never go to the hair salon. Like there's lots of, my house is a mess, lots of things that I'm not doing that other people might prioritize. But my priorities are my empire, the world, my kids, you know, and so that's what I make it happen.
The last question I always like to ask on the podcast, if the guest has been, is a LeanPub author, is if there's one thing that we could, magical feature that we could build or create for you that you could ask us to do, or if there was one thing that had you shaking your fist going, damn you, Lean Pub, why does this suck? Please fix it. Is there something you can think of that you would ask us to do for you?
You know, honestly, I can't really, I mean, because I've worked with different tools. Like, do you all have a book cover generator?
We do not.
So that could be good. That could be good because I think people don't know what to do with their book cover. And I hired a branding coach. Well, I turned 50 and this is a new world. So I hired a branding coach. She's teaching me how to use Instagram. She's a photographer. She took all those photos. So I had somebody, but I think that a book cover generator might be nice or some advice around that. But honestly, it was so easy. At first I thought I wouldn't be able to do the markdown very well. And so I tried the other one and that was fine. But then I got frustrated that I couldn't do the granularity of like the markdown that so I switched it and it was so easy. So don't be intimidated by markdown. And the other thing is I did not go through your course, but I noted that your course is there. You have the video, like all the stuff, like how to kind
oh,
of
yes.
stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you call that? Like the little guide. I didn't go through that. The videos.
Oh,
I
really?
Bet. I bet that would have been like for my next one. I'm definitely going to go through that and see if there's anything that I missed. It was super useful. Like it took me a minute. It took me a minute to figure out how to get the chapter, like that I in the markdown that I needed the chapters to, like the headings to make the chapters generate. That was a piece of it. And then also, I used Microsoft Edge at first.
Oh.
That was a mistake because when I was in the markdown, I couldn't see the editing and things that you can see on that left-hand window. I couldn't see that.
Oh.
In Edge. That I was expecting, but the minute I changed it to Chrome, I could, and that could have just been my system. But I mean, seriously, that was me without even looking at the manual. So I did this like on a Friday morning. Like I'm serious. Like I wrote it up in Word and I put it in there and like on a, like it was like a Friday morning and I did it. I was like, I just put a whole book up here. I can't believe it. And then like you called me. So it was, listen, this was easy, like compared to some things I've done. You got to remember though, I used to enter data by hand before the internet. So
Yeah. Well, that's great to hear. Thank you so much for sharing that. I mean, you know, when we hear that people can kind of, you know, go from Word to our, you know, one of our writing modes, in your case, you're using the browser plain text writing mode. That's, we've always hoped that one day we'd have iterated with enough feedback from authors and design to be at the point where someone could do exactly what you just said, which is like, I've written it in Word, I've done something else. Now I've come to LeanPub. Oh, there's all kinds of cool reasons for me to not just convert to a PDF and upload it, but actually get on LeanPub. And the fact that you could do that without reading the documentation or the tutorials and watch the videos is fantastic.
Yeah. It's lovely too. The format is it's beautiful. And I read Roger Peng's book.
Oh.
Which is a classic, excellent book. Mm-hmm. And that was part of it too. I thought, well, Roger Peng and that beautiful book is on LeanPub. Like, oh, I think, and it really looks beautiful. It looks legit, like it, you know, and I was very impressed with that, much more than just a regular old PDF or something. It's really, really, really user-friendly.
Well, thank you very much for sharing that. And thank you very much for taking the time to do this LeanPub podcast episode with me today. The book is 10 Habits of Great Data Analysts, Practical Tips from My 3 Decades in the Field by Dr. Danielle Boyce. Thank you very much, Danielle, for being here today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
And as always, thanks to all of you for listening to this episode of the Front Matter Podcast. If you like what you heard, please rate and review it wherever you found it. And if you'd like to be a LeanPub author yourself, please check out our website at leanpub.com. Thanks.